mentioned that every now and then I will mention a principle of the Talmud concerning studying the Talmud. And since David last week brought up some statements that somebody made about certain texts of the Talmud, I would like to just, before we get on with our regular Talmud session, let me just quote to you a piece of Talmud. I'm just going to translate it exactly. This is what it says. It says, the possessions, which means the land of a non-Jew, they are as a desert. Whoever wishes to take hold of them, in other words, to occupy them as an owner, can do so and keep them. Okay? Now, this, of course, sounds like any non-Jew. You just go over to his property and just kick him off and just take it over. Now, this is in the Talmud in Baba Basra, and that's 54b. Of course, what it really means is as follows. What it means is if there's a transaction where a non-Jew is selling a piece of land to a Jew. So the Talmud states that the way the transaction is performed by the non-Jew is the way he relinquishes possession. In other words, let's say I'm going to buy a piece of land from a non-Jew. This is speaking not in our society. And of course, in our society, you go according to the law of the land. But let's say in the Jewish society. So the law is like this, that the non-Jew only has one way of acquiring or relinquishing property, and that is through payment. So what it really means is this. If I go and I pay a non-Jew for a piece of property, okay, buy a piece of property for $100,000, I give him the money, and then I don't get a document. So the Talmud says that the Jew, that the non-Jew got his money, and he's off the property. Now, the Jew, since usually, speaking in a place where usually when these type of transactions take place, they usually use a document, a deed, okay? A deed is usually used. Now, the Talmud states that usually when a person, in a place where people use a deed, so the Jew doesn't really intend to acquire the land until he gets his deed. So what happens is like this. That the non-Jew got his payment, and he's out of the land. The Jew didn't get the deed yet, and since he can, one of the methods that a Jew can acquire land is through the deed, he really didn't intend to acquire the land until he got the deed. So what happens is that he's tough out of luck, because that land, even though he paid for it, it's not his yet because he didn't acquire the deed. So if another Jew jumps in and takes over that land, so the first Jew is going to lose out because he didn't acquire the property yet. So the truth of the matter is that piece of Talmud is stating the exact opposite. It's not stating that the non-Jew is at a loss, as it sounds. On the contrary, the non-Jew is the one that got his money, and he's fine. But the Jew, since he didn't acquire the land yet because he had in mind to acquire the land through the method of a deed, so he's tough out of luck because he paid money. He doesn't have anything. And if another Jew comes by and takes it, so then the second Jew would own it. So the first Jew would be tough out of luck. And then the Gemara goes into a whole discussion of what exactly would happen. I'm not going to get involved in it.
Rebbe?
It's a technical area.
Rebbe?
Go right ahead.
Can you hear me? Okay. I didn't know if you can hear. We changed things up just a little bit.
Okay.
And hoping that we improve some quality here. Could you read the Talmudic statement again?
Okay, I'll read the statement.
Okay.
Perfect example. Just so happens I've been studying this piece of Talmud with my class, and when I saw it, I said, this is just a perfect example to use to show you exactly how you could quote a piece of Talmud verbatim and have the opposite idea of what's going on. This is a statement. The properties, it means real estate properties, of a non-Jew, they are as a desert. And whoever takes hold and takes possession of them, owns them. Stop. That is an exact quote of the Talmud. Now, anyone that hears that quote would assume that what the Talmud means is you could just go over to a non-Jew, take his property, kick him off, and that's it. It's yours. Right? Isn't that what it sounds like? Okay. Now, let me tell you, in fact, what it means. And if anyone goes further, a few lines, you'll see exactly the Talmud explains what it means. What it means is it doesn't mean the property of a non-Jew who's sitting on his property. It's speaking about a case where a non-Jew is selling property to a Jew. Okay? In other words, you have a non-Jew, he has a nice house, $100,000, he wants to sell it to a Jew. That's the case. It doesn't mean the properties of a non-Jew per se. It means if there's a transaction of properties between a non-Jew and a Jew, so what happens is like this, that the Jew will not acquire the property until he receives a deed. The non-Jew, the moment he receives his payment, he has done his part of the transaction. So when you have a piece of property, so if I own a house and I want to sell it to you, so two things are taking place. I'm removing my ownership and you are establishing your ownership. Is that correct? Okay. So there's two components here. The previous owner is relinquishing, removing his ownership. The new owner is acquiring ownership. So the Talmud says, usually these two things happen simultaneously. But the Talmud says it's possible that there should be a gap sometimes, which means that A relinquishes his ownership, but B didn't acquire his ownership yet. So now you have like a neutral territory where no one owns this property. What happens in such a case is if an outsider, a third party, comes in and actually does an action which would render the object his, so he is the one that would be the rightful owner, according to halacha. Now, I don't want to go into the whole subject. I can answer all the questions that you may want to ask about it, but it's peripheral. My main point is I'm trying to show you is this, that what the Talmud really means, and if you just read the Talmud a few lines later, it means like this. It means the properties of a non-Jew that were transferred to a Jew through a monetary payment. In other words, A is a non-Jew. B is a Jew. B went over to A and paid A $100,000 for his house. Okay, real estate. Now, what the Talmud is saying is, but B, the Jew, did not receive a deed yet. So the Talmud says as follows. A, the Gentile, when he received his money, he's out. In other words, he sold his property, got his money, goodbye, he's finished. He goes home, that's it. He made his money. The Jew, however, even though he gave his money, still didn't acquire the property because for the Jew to acquire the property, he must have a deed, and he didn't get his deed yet. It's speaking in such a case where the Gentile did not give the Jew the deed. In other words, the Jew wasn't cautious. He said, I'll get the deed tomorrow. So the Talmud says that according to halacha, what happened here is that this Jew is at a loss because he... The Gentile already got his money, went home. He doesn't have any more ownership. The Jew didn't acquire it. He didn't establish any kind of possession on the land. So if you have land that no one possesses, the law is anyone that comes over and does an action which demonstrates ownership, that's his. So the Talmud actually means that the Jew B is at a loss because if C comes by and actually establishes ownership on the land through one of the methods that legally establish ownership, then B lost his money, doesn't have his land, and he's out. So the Talmud means the exact opposite than on the surface you would think it means. Because on the surface you think it means you just go with the Gentile and just kick him off land and then you own it. What it really means is speaking about a case where a Gentile sold the land to the Jew, and the Jew didn't receive the deed. So the Gentile sold his property, he got his money, he's fine. But the Jew is in a neutral zone because he's not going to own that land until he gets the deed. So until he gets the deed, the land is in a neutral state. Now if another Jew comes by and takes ownership, it's going to belong to that third party. Okay? So there's a perfect example of a statement. If you take it out of context and just translate it verbatim, it sounds exactly the opposite than it really is, because it sounds like the Talmud is saying that the Gentile has no ownership, just it's like a desert. What it really means is that the Jew who is the one that's suffering because it's like a desert, because the Gentile received his money, and he's fine. But the Jew didn't acquire it yet, so it's like a desert. It means anyone that wants to come by can just take possession over it. It's in a neutral zone between components of the transaction. Because, as I said before, every transaction has two components. The original owner has to relinquish ownership. The new owner has to acquire possession. And usually it happens simultaneously. But the Talmud is giving you a case, an instance, that it's about to analyze where you could have a neutral zone where A relinquishes, B didn't acquire. Now it's in no man's land, so then C can come in and grab it. And that's what the Talmud discusses for the next two pages. Okay? So it's just like a perfect example of someone. I could just see someone just taking the statement out verbatim and saying, well, it's in the Talmud. but it's in the Talmud, but it means exactly the opposite of what you would think if you just look at it superficially. Now, what I want to explain over here is, why is it that the Talmud, in fact, is written that way? Someone will say, well, why did the Talmud write that way? So the answer is, of course, if you went two lines further in the Talmud, you'd see that that's the case. But because they mention the fact that the Gentile received his money, but the Jew didn't own the property because he didn't get his deed yet. So if you went two lines further, you'd figure it out. But why does the Talmud speak this way? That's a question that bothers a lot of people. And the answer is extremely important. The answer is that the Talmud is not written as a book of instruction. Like if you go today and want to buy a book on medicine. So the book is written for you to learn how to gain some knowledge of medicine, or certain procedures, or whatever it might be. But the Talmud is not written that way. The Talmud wasn't written in this century even as a didactic book. What is the Talmud? The Talmud is a recording of discussions by the scholars of Israel, the greatest scholars of Israel at the time. Now, these scholars, when they were talking to each other, each one knew the entire Talmud. So, in the Talmud, every piece of Talmud assumes that you know every other piece of Talmud. Because these were men that spent their lives not just memorizing every word of the Tanakh and every word of the Mishnah, but these were people that understood the ideas behind it as well. So when you were a scholar, you know, you talk shorthand. When you speak to somebody, you assume he knows. Obviously, if he says, well, the property of a Gentile is like a desert. Well, obviously, it obviously can't mean that a Gentile doesn't have any possession, because the Talmud states openly that the Torah says that a Gentile inherits. It says that I've given Esau an inheritance of the Mount Seir, which means a Gentile inherits property and owns property. It's openly in the Torah that a Gentile has ownership just like a Jew does, and he has rights of ownership. The generation of the flood were destroyed because they violated ownership. Ownership predates Torah. So anyone that has any kind of basic knowledge would know that this statement can't mean what it seems on the surface. And therefore, they realize that it means the property of a Gentile is being transferred to a Jew. It's referring to the transaction. It's not referring to the property in its static state when it belongs to the Gentile. So the point I'm trying to make is that every piece of Talmud presupposes knowledge of every other piece of Talmud, and that's why the rabbis often speak in shorthand. You see, you have to understand something else as well, and that is that when these conversations among the rabbis were recorded, they were memorized, and they weren't allowed to be written down at the time. So in order to memorize it, they used to try to abbreviate it, make it very concise, so that it's not so much of a strain on the mind. So anything which involved knowledge from other areas, they never put down, because they assume that if you're a scholar, you know this. It's scholars here that they're relating to. So that is why in the Talmud, when you have a statement, you could never look at that statement without looking at the entire Talmud. It's assuming that you know everything. It's not written as a book of instruction. And that, I think, is the foremost problem in the study of Talmud. That's why many people, as they've mentioned last week, they quote pieces of Talmud and they say, how could this be? This is unfair. It's unjust. That's because they're taking that statement and they're not scholars and they don't know the other statements. So they assume that the meaning is exactly as that word is, when they don't realize that when these rabbis were discussing something, they knew that didn't mean that, because it couldn't mean that, because that's an obvious fact that's known in another piece of Talmud. So they knew that it had to mean the transaction, as in this case. It had to be, it was referring to a transaction. It wasn't referring to it wasn't a blanket statement about ownership of a Gentile. We know that a Gentile has ownership. Every human being has ownership. But what happens precisely is what I'm trying to inform you about, and that is that whenever you read the Talmud, you have to be very cautious. You have to realize that a person cannot really be a scholar in Talmud unless he knows the entire Talmud. So when he sees one statement, he can't take it out of context. That's why it's extremely important to read the interpretations, because the medieval interpretations, they were scholars that have the entire Talmud, you know, in their back pocket, so to speak. And what they do is they explain to you exactly what's going on in the Talmud. But a person that reads the Talmud in English, like he has in Cincino, he doesn't have access to the interpretations. And therefore, he oftentimes, most of the time, I would say, would be totally confused. Because without the interpretations, you really can't know what's going on in the Talmud. So I just mention that to you because I think it's a very important basic principle to realize that this book is written differently than books are written today. We often, you know, we're always used to assuming the way things are today, and that's the way things were. We treat everything the same way. You have to realize this comes from a different era, and these are discussions by people who are extremely knowledgeable, and they can speak in shorthand, and it looks like they mean one thing, but they mean something else completely. The only way you can know is, of course, studying the authentic interpreters of the Talmud who do write didactically, who do really explain what the Talmud means. And once you see it, then you see exactly how everything fits in. Okay, are there any questions?
All right, I think that pretty well covered it. We need to begin back where we left off last week.
Okay.
With the statement from Exodus about the image of God. You know, he deals with all the, you don't make me like anything in heaven above, earth beneath, or creeping, crawling things and all that.
One second, did we do that last week?
Excuse me?
I don't remember leaving off on that point.
All right, that was the question that James Buchanan asked.
I thought he asked the question about the Ten Commandments.
All right, well, that's what he was talking about in relation to the Ten Commandments. Can you hear him?
James Buchanan raised the question, what does it mean when it says you shouldn't take the Lord God's name in vain?
All right.
Am I right?
That is correct. That's in verse 7. But then he also, I thought the question was where God says, you're not to make unto me any graven images, things heaven above, earth beneath, and the whole thing in relation to the concept of God. Is that correct, Jim? All right, wait a minute. Let's just let him rephrase his question rather than you interpreting my interpretation of his question.
Good idea.
Good idea. We don't have any Talmud on this, but I got a telephone.
See that?
No, I just asked how the verse in Exodus about taking God's name in vain relates to what you were talking about
exactly
last week about cursing.
Okay,
God's
and
name.
I said we're going to take it up this week.
Yeah,
and we're going to do it right now.
That's correct.
The Talmud, okay?
Okay.
Okay. Now, the Talmud continues with the, going into the definition of what it means to curse God and precisely defining it. And the Talmud, of course, exhausts every possibility. Now, the Talmud states as follows. It offers a possibility. I don't know if you people have. Are you people have a Cincino text in front of you? If you do, it'll be very helpful. But the Talmud states it should be. Well, I have a different. I can't tell you where it is because I don't have it in front of me. If you do have one, I could get one actually, and I could show you exactly where we're reading in the Talmud. So you'll see the text and then.
All right, we have Cincino Talmud.
You do have it right in front of you.
No, but I can walk right up to the office and get it. They can listen to you and I as we walk.
Oh, okay.
All right. Which so you tell me what you want.
You need Sanhedrin 56K.
All right. I'll walk right in here.
Okay.
And I will find.
I'm showing you where I'm reading. Okay.
I hope John, he just took a... All right, I got Sanhedrin right here. And I'll walk back down there with it. You want Sanhedrin 56A?
Okay. 56A, right.
Okay.
And after, have you got the Mishnah there?
Okay, well, I haven't got it opened yet. I'll just walk back down here. Here, open that up. I don't have my glasses on. 56A. Hello? Are you still there? Did I key you on that one?
For me?
Alright, I have the Gemara, and you want, the Mishnah, Talmud 56. Hey, alright, now what do you want me to,
Okay. Now we went through the possibilities of maybe it means writing God's name on a piece of wood and drilling a hole through it, remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And then the Talmud rejects that one.
Mm-hmm.
And now the Talmud offers another possibility. So we're up to that point in the Talmud where they offer another possibility.
Okay.
And the Talmud says maybe, you see, what they're trying to do is they're going back to the verse in the Torah, and that's the verse in Leviticus 24,
mm-hmm.
where it says, he who curses the name will be shall be put to death.
It says... And the Sanhedrin said, and he that blasphemeth
Nokeb,
the name of the Lord,
right.
When he blasphemes the name of the Lord, he shall be put to death.
That's correct. That's
and how do you know what the word Nokeb means?
That's right.
Okay.
The Talmud explains that Nokeb means to curse. But now the Talmud says, but one second, the word Nokeb is found somewhere else in the Torah. It's found in Numbers, and there it says, there the word means, it says, and Moses and Aaron took the people that were clearly pronounced by name. So there the word Nokeb means to enunciate properly. So now the Talmud says, so since the word Nokeb could mean curse, as we have demonstrated from Balaam, from Numbers 23, but I could show you from Numbers 1 that same word can also mean to enunciate clearly, because it speaks about the people that were, Moses and Aaron took the people that were whose names were clearly enunciated. Okay? And if you want me to find the exact text, I could do that for you. If that's important. It's in Numbers 1. Give me one second over here. Yes, it's Numbers 1:17. All right, it says when it tells you the ones that should be in charge of counting the nation. So it says Moses and Aaron took these people who were clearly pronounced by name above. Okay, so there the word Nokeb is used again. So now the Talmud comes back and says, fine, you've shown me that the word Nokeb means curse. That is true. But the word has another meaning elsewhere, and there it means to pronounce. So the Talmud says, so why can I not say, when the Torah says in Leviticus, Nokeb, you use the word Nokeb, blaspheme, maybe it doesn't mean that he curses God. What it means is he pronounces the name of God. All right? So that's what the Talmud says. Why can I not say that it means to enunciate the name? All right? And the Talmud continues, because we mentioned last week that it's a principle in the Torah that the Torah doesn't just give out a punishment, but the Torah always has a warning, a violation, because the Torah is not a book of punishment. The Torah is the reason why the Torah... does mention punishment is simply for the it's a necessity, because of a societal necessity, and also of course for the person himself, but it's basically a societal necessity. But the reason the punishment stems from some evil, so the Torah always has to tell you before, or in other words, wherever the Torah gives a punishment, there also must be a verse that tells you that this is an evil thing. Because the Torah is not simply a book of punishment. The Torah is a book which really describes good and evil, teaches you good and evil, and then punishments are a secondary matter. But you must have, in the Torah, there always must be a statement. If there's a punishment, there must be another statement somewhere that says this is an evil. So that's why the Talmud says that over here we could work it this way. We could say that when it says blaspheme, you use the word nokev, it doesn't really mean blaspheme. What it means is to pronounce God's name. And the place where the Torah tells you that you should not pronounce God's name, and that means the name of four letters, Yud K Vav K, the Y H V A, where it says where does it say that that's an evil thing to do? So it says, so the Talmud says that is derived from Deuteronomy, because in Deuteronomy it says you should fear the Lord your God. And fearing the Lord your God means you should not pronounce His name. Okay, that's what it means when it says fearing the Lord your God. Okay, now this is an extremely important thing. Why? Because it's important, and now you'll see why it's important to learn Torah. For Ben Israel, Ben Noach, makes no difference. You have to learn Torah, otherwise you're not going to understand Torah. You're not going to understand what to do and what not to do. Now here, the Talmud is entertaining a possibility. The possibility that Talmud is entertaining is that when the Torah says that a person is to be put to death, it's not discussing blasphemy. It's discussing simply the enunciation of the YHVA. All right? And the Talmud says, of course, where does the Torah say that's evil to do it? Talmud says, because it says you must fear the Lord your God. Fearing the Lord your God means you should not pronounce His name. Now, why is that called fearing the Lord your God? Okay, does anyone have any suggestion for that? Why should that be called fearing the Lord your God, not to pronounce His name? All right, if there are no hands up, then I'll give you the answer. The answer is because this is done by a human being. For instance, an important person like a king. You'll notice in Tanakh when they speak to King David, they'll say, "My master, the king." They don't just call him David because it's inappropriate. If you have respect and you have a fear of an individual, you don't call him by his name. That's why you see even in American courts, "Your Honor," the judge, "Your Honor." So this is a sign of respect. So therefore, the Talmud says that when it says that you should fear the Lord your God, this means you certainly must have at least as much respect for God as for man. It should be really infinite times more. So that's why the Talmud says that maybe when the Torah says that a person who is nokev the name of God, what it means is not that he curses God. It means something far less. It means if he enunciates God's name, that would be a degradation. That would show a lack of respect. And perhaps for that crime, he should be put to death. This is what the Talmud is entertaining as a possibility. Now, we'll see how the Talmud rules it out. But the Talmud is entertaining that possibility at this point. So you'll say, well, it's only a possibility. Why is it important? I'll tell you why it's extremely important, and especially for a Ben Noach. And that is because, as we mentioned, when you study the Talmud, you become aware of the fact that these seven laws are just basic laws that give a person a right to simply walk this earth. It's only the beginning, the very foundation of society. But then perfection has to take place, just like for the Ben Israel, through the study, the proper study of Torah. The Torah, the written law, and the explanation of what the Torah is all about, which is the oral law. Now, when the Talmud entertains this possibility, it shows you one thing. It's true that the Talmud rejects it. And really what the Torah means when it says no cave, it means blasphemy. But nevertheless, you see, the Talmud stated that it could have, there is a possibility, the Talmud entertained the possibility, it could mean just to pronounce God's name, could have been interpreted as being such a serious violation that one would be put to death. Now, even though the Talmud rejects it, that possibility is still not an insane, not a crazy possibility. What does it... So, if the Talmud entertains the possibility that enunciating, the mere enunciation of the name of God is a violation, that it would make sense to say the Torah could have, it would make sense to say that just for that violation the person should be put to death, even though in fact the Talmud retracts and shows you that's not the case. But still, that shows you that such a violation is a serious violation. It's a disrespect to God. Therefore, any Ben Noach that is interested in perfection will never pronounce God's name because it's disrespectful. It's a violation of what the Torah says in Deuteronomy, that you should fear the Lord your God, and you should certainly accord to God the amount of respect that one would accord to a very great person. Certainly at least that much, but of course infinitely more. So from this piece of Talmudic text where the Talmud entertains a possibility, there is a very important thing that a Ben Noach can derive from this, and that is, if he's interested in perfection, he's learned something. He's learned the fact that it is seriously wrong to pronounce the name of God that is used with the YHVA. One should not try to pronounce that in any way whatsoever.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Question at this point.
Okay.
All right. When we talk about pronouncing the name,
right,
are we talking about the pronunciation phonetically in the correct manner?
That's correct.
All right. So if I say the letters of the name,
right,
since only the high priest spoke that on the day of Yom Kippur,
right,
if I'm saying the name and I'm just identifying it as God, then if I'm not saying it properly, I'm not guilty of blasphemy.
That's correct. Well, you wouldn't be guilty of blasphemy anyways, because the Talmud shows that that's not really blasphemy. But
okay,
you wouldn't even be guilty of pronouncing the name of God if you
didn't
pronounce it properly.
Right.
That's correct. But the only thing that's true, we don't know what the proper pronunciation is today. No one knows what the proper pronunciation is. But it would be certainly is proper for an individual not to try to put those four letters together in any way whatsoever. Because if you did happen to pronounce it properly, then that would be a serious degradation of God's name. So therefore, I think it's wrong when I see people that do try to pronounce it. And certainly people who do try to pronounce it and who think that they do have the correct pronunciation, and there are people like that, and they think that they're drawing closer to God by pronouncing his name, when in reality there's nothing could be further from the truth. What they are doing is they're removing themselves from God by showing obvious blatant disrespect. And the only thing we could say about a person like that is he's not fit to be put to death, because it turns out that the Talmud states that that's not what is meant by the statement in Leviticus that no cave is to pronounce God's name, but actually it means blasphemy. But the Talmud is entertaining the possibility. So the only thing we could say about such a person is, while he has committed a horrible deed, he's not to be put to death. But is he a perfected individual? Absolutely not. Did he do something improper? 100%. He's failed to show respect for God. And this is a very serious violation in terms of human perfection. So again, we come back to the idea that it's extremely important to learn Talmud and become familiar with the interpretations of the Torah in order to be able to perfect ourselves beyond the violations of the serious violations which incur a death penalty involving the seven laws. There's something that's much more important for an individual that's looking for perfection, such as something as this. There is also one more point I'd like to mention. Many people try to pronounce that name, YHVA, and a lot of them think that they have the correct pronunciation, and the reason they do is, again, they think they're drawing close to God. But what they fail to understand is that this really is a very primitive kind of expression. You see, idolaters, when they try to use various names of their gods, and they think that by using these names they're going to gain certain powers over the gods, and the gods will recognize them to a greater degree because they have this intimate use of a name. Now, that is really a very primitive expression. And primitivism and idolatry are synonymous. And what happens oftentimes is people, I know there's a group, I've seen this group where they have, in Hebrew, I saw on their bus, they have the holy name of God. They have the Yud, the He, the Vav, and the He. And they think that by having that name and pronouncing it, that they are special to God by doing that. What they are actually doing is complete disrespect, and they're involving themselves in a very primitive kind of activity in which they think that somehow or other, by saying this name, that they're going to gain special favor from God. When what God wants a person to do is to gain knowledge and perfection and to have an awe and a respect for God. That's where there's perfection, not by using words. Words, this is completely an idolatrous type of thinking. So, it's extremely important for a person to realize when he studies Torah that the benefit of studying Torah is more than just the knowledge of the seven mitzvot. It's even the knowledge that you obtain when the Talmud is entertaining a possibility. This teaches you something which is very important in terms of your own perfection and your own approach to God and your own direction in life and how a person truly gets close to God. And that is through knowledge and through understanding, not through incantations of names. So I just thought I'd mention that because I know that there are people, I have seen many people who think somehow or other by pronouncing that name that they're going to gain some favor in God's eyes, when the exact opposite is really the truth. It is a very serious, it is a serious violation. A person must show the highest awe possible for God, and that awe involves not enunciating the name which we use, which is our greatest reference to the Creator. Okay, the name that has the concept of God's existence. Okay, that's one point I wanted to make over here. Now I wanted to James, the question James asked is very pertinent here also, because in Exodus 20, the third of the Ten Commandments, 27, it states that one should not take the name of the Lord God for nothing. Now, do you have that verse? You shall not take the name of the Lord God and for nothing, in vain, because, and it says. Because
all right, and the English translation is you don't take the Lord name in vain.
Oh, and that translation? Do not take the name of the Lord God in vain. Okay.
Okay.
Now I ask you to compare that with Leviticus, compare that statement with Leviticus 19, Leviticus 19:12. Have you got that? 19:12. Excuse me? Okay, 19:12, where it says, "You shall not swear by my name falsely." Okay? Now, the interpretation of the verse in Exodus, the one of the Ten Commandments, is the basic interpretation of the oral law is that that is also referring to a swear. Okay? Halachically, it's referring to a swear. It's not just, we'll get back to that in a second about just mentioning God's name in vain. But really, when it says, it uses the word losisa, it means to say a swear. You should not swear by the name of the Lord your God in vain. Now, again, compare that with Leviticus 19:12. You shouldn't swear in my name falsely. Now, we see here two different things. There's swearing in vain, and then there's swearing falsely. Now, what is the difference between these two things? And the Talmud explains that the difference is these are two different cases. There are basically two different swears which are seriously prohibited by the Torah. And that is swearing in vain and swearing falsely. Okay, well, let's take falsely first. Falsely is quite simple. Falsely means if a person says, he swears, he God's name that he will do such and such a thing, let's say tomorrow. Okay. And he doesn't do it. So he swore falsely. Or if he swears that he did something and he actually didn't do it. So then he's swearing falsely. That's Leviticus. Now, in Exodus, in the Ten Commandments, what it means is swearing in vain is a completely different thing. It means to say if a person should say, for instance, let's say, for instance, there's an object which is metal, and he says, this object is steel, and actually it's copper. So it's obviously false. That's considered in vain. Or if you should say, let's say there's an object which is copper, and everybody can see it's copper, and he says, this I swear, and he swears by God's name that this is copper. That's also called in vain. In vain means where it is obviously false or obviously true. Either way, either if it's obviously false or if it's obviously true, it's in vain. Why is that called in vain? Okay, because we have to understand what the concept of a swear is. When a person swears by God's name, he means to say that the statement that he's making, he is looking for substantiation. And he's giving the highest form of substantiation, and that is his recognition of God. So he's swearing by God's name means that this is true, and it is. I say that this is true just as I know God exists. So he's actually using the existence of God to support his statement. Now, if a person swears falsely, that's a terrible thing, because what he is doing is that's a degradation of God, because here he used his concept of God's existence to support a statement, and now he lies. So what he is, that is considered one of the worst sins. As a matter of fact, Ibn Ezra states that if you know, look at the Ten Commandments, you'll only find two commandments that mention anything about reward and punishment. And one is honoring your father and mother, where it states the good that will happen to you if you do. And the second one is this one, where it says, because God will not forgive, I don't know how your translation is, but God will not forgive anyone who mentions his name in vain. So, and Ibn Ezra goes on to say that if you look throughout the Tanakh, you find that this principle is expressed in several places. For instance, if you remember the case of Saul and Jonathan, where the nation accepted by a swear that they wouldn't eat until the end of the battle, and Jonathan didn't hear the swear, and he ate from the honey in the field, and then at one point they thought that they would put him to death because of doing that. Actually, he didn't hear the swear. But you see that a swear is so serious that in violation of a swear, oftentimes a person is really fit to be put to death. And you have that several places in the Tanakh. He mentions the other places as well. For instance, why the incident where they swore to the Gibeonites. And then because they broke that swear, So the house of Saul was put to death. I don't know if you remember that, but the Ibn Ezra points out that you see the seriousness of the offense of swearing falsely, and this is considered. He says this is worse actually than even murder, and the other Ten Commandments, stealing or murder or sexual violations. He says this is worse, and he explains why it's worse. He says it's worse because in those other cases, for instance, take the case of murder. So murder is a passionate crime where a person can be overcome by his instincts. So he could give some mitigating circumstances for it. You could say, well, look, he was, at the time, he was so overpowered with anger that he killed this person. He says, but swearing falsely is a verbal thing. He says, you can't say, it's not an instinctual type of a thing. So he says this is something where the person doesn't even have any mitigating circumstances. And here what he's doing is degrading the name of God, which is the worst thing they could possibly do. He says that's why in the Ten Commandments, this is the only one where it states that God will not forgive a person who does this because of the seriousness of the infraction. There's no mitigating circumstances. So, of course, you'll ask me, if that's the case, why doesn't a person get the death penalty for swearing falsely? And the reason is, and this is also an important thing, that, you know, we are discussing here many times the punishments that take place if a person violates the Torah law. But I want to make it clear, the importance of studying about the punishments is not really for the punishments themselves, because we don't have a Sanhedrin today. But the importance is, it gives us some insight into the seriousness of the offense. And that's important, that a person should know in his mind. The Torah insists that a person not just avoid evil, but a person has to study and know evil, and know what is more evil and what is less evil, and know the various gradations of evil. Knowledge of evil is extremely important in Torah. Knowledge of good is important, and knowledge of evil is important. The person must know all these areas if he wants to be a perfected individual, so he knows what is more serious, what is less serious, and he has an understanding of evil. The important thing in Torah is understanding and knowledge. So when a person understands what evil is, then his soul is guided towards the good, just like when a person knows what the good is. You have to have knowledge of both sides of the ethical standard. So the Ibn Ezra, however, what he's saying is that the punishment doesn't always indicate, even though it's a good barometer of how serious a crime might be, a particular action might be, but it's not always a 100% barometer. Because sometimes the reason why there is no penalty is not because the crime is less serious. It's because of the fact that there are certain other considerations. For instance, over here, the person, when he swears falsely, it's only a verbal action. And as part of the Torah system, the Torah usually does not give serious penalties to verbal actions, because a person, even though it might be extremely serious, because it shows, a verbal action shows what's going on in the person's mind, which is really his soul, and it could show a total distortion of his soul. But nevertheless, if a person didn't do a performance, so the Torah does not feel that in such an instance that a serious punishment is appropriate. Various reasons for that, why that might be so. But the fact is that even though the Sanhedrin will not put the person to death, this does not mean that the state of his soul is not seriously impaired. So what the Ibn Ezra is saying is that this really is the most serious, is perhaps the, well, second to idolatry. Of course, idolatry is the major, most major violations are. But second to idolatry, this is the most serious of the Ten Commandments, Ibn Ezra makes the point. And what it's discussing is swearing in vain. Okay. Now, let me explain. Let me get back to this. I know there are a couple of loose ends here, but let me just go to the point that we mentioned last time. There's a difference between swearing in vain and between swearing falsely. Okay. Swearing falsely, again, is where a person swears he will do something and he doesn't do it, or that he did something and he didn't do it. That's a distortion, because he's swearing by God and he's lying, which means to say that it is a total degradation, an active degradation of his concept of God and his relationship to God. The other case is where he swears in vain. It doesn't seem so serious at first. You say, well, what is so terrible if the person, he's in a room with people, and he makes the statement that this piece of silver, he swears that it's a piece of silver. Whatever reason he might have. I mean, we can always find motivations. But what is so terrible about doing that? And the Torah, you see, has that in the Ten Commandments. And the reason is because if a person uses God's name for substantiation and there's no need for substantiation, that itself is the greatest degradation. It means that he has no concept of fear of God. You don't bring God into the picture unless there's some valid reason. But if you just bring him in frivolously, that itself is the greatest degradation. So it comes out that these two verses, the verse in Exodus 20, verse 7, and in Leviticus 19:12, are really like two components of same thing. One is where you swear in vain, and the other one is where you swear falsely. And the Torah chose as one of the Ten Commandments the case which is even easier, where you would think on the surface, well, that's not so bad. At least he didn't say anything false. But no, the Torah chose that one as the one of the Ten Commandments to teach you that even that is the most serious offense. To use God frivolously when there's no need to substantiate something is itself the greatest degradation, because then it means that he's using God as a commonplace. There's no reason to introduce God here. And if you introduce God in a case where there is no need to, then it shows you have no respect for the Creator, no respect for God, and that is a violation which the stated in the Ten Commandments, that God does not forgive that sin like that. He doesn't allow a sin, such a sin, to just go by lightly. It's not something which it shows you that that man's concept of the Creator is totally lacking. And he doesn't have the proper awe and the proper idea and the proper place in his mind for the Creator of the universe. So that's why that's such a serious offense. Now, the Ramban states that this violation would also include just the enunciation of, just the mere enunciation of God's name, just as we're discussing here in the Talmud and Sanhedrin. Ramban says that would include that as well, peripherally, although halachically it is referring to the type of statement that I mentioned before, where a person uses God to substantiate something which is obviously true or obviously false, which means there's no need to introduce God here, and that is the halachic form. But Nachmanides states that's true, that's the halachic form, but nevertheless, he says, the statement also includes any individual who merely enunciates God's name. He says that also would be included in the same class of violation. Because, again, what he's doing is he's treating God as commonplace. And it shows a distortion and a total lack of appreciation of the proper place in a human being's mind for the idea of the Creator. Okay, so that... that is really what I have to say on the regard to James' question, and that's what I thought was a very valid question, because that's precisely the area that the Talmud is dealing with right now with regard to blasphemy. So you see, when we discuss blasphemy in the Talmud, it becomes more than just blasphemy. It becomes, you go into other areas as well, which are peripheral, but again, extremely important. Now let's see what the Talmud states. So the Talmud says that cannot be the interpretation of the verse in Leviticus, which speaks about no cave, the one that we commonly understand as blasphemy. It cannot mean just enunciating God's name. Why? Because he says we already have the formula for the curse, where you have God as the subject, as we mentioned, and God as the object. So that means that God's name has to appear twice, and that won't work if the violation is simply to enunciate God's name. It doesn't fit the formula that we have, because we explained last time that verse is referring to the use of God's name twice, that there are two levels there, and the more serious level is the one that is that one is culpable for the death penalty. And if it's just mentioning God's name, there is no, you can't use the name of God twice, would have no meaning in such a situation. Okay, so that's why the Talmud rejects that. And then the Talmud states as follows. Now the Talmud's like this. All right. It says also, because it says like this, because it says in Leviticus 24, that chapter that deals with blasphemy, it's where it discusses what the person who blasphemed did. It states vayikov, the word we're discussing, and also it says vayikalel, which means any curses. So you see that there the word means to curse. So the Talmud states as follows. Talmud states that maybe it means two things. Maybe it means the enunciation of God's name plus cursing God. They have to do both. So the Talmud rejects that because in the incident it states that God told Moses, take out the man who cursed. And it doesn't say two things. It just says the man who cursed. Obviously he only did one thing. So therefore the Talmud concludes it must be one type of performance, and it must be a performance in which God is used as the subject and as the object. Therefore, it cannot that verse in the Torah cannot be referring to just merely stating God's name in vain, just using God's name for no reason at all. And therefore, the Talmud concludes that that verse can only be interpreted if you interpret the structure of the verse properly. It can only mean what we are stating, namely that the curse of God means he uses God as a subject. And he uses God as an object, and when he does that, then he's involved in something which is of the most serious level of blasphemy, and that's the conclusion of this piece of Talmudic analysis. The Talmud goes on further, but I think that we will stop over here. Unless what I'd like to do is, does anyone have?
Well, I pushed the button too soon.
Okay.
I picked the phone up and didn't mean to. So, do you hear a roar on your end when we do that?
Yes, I do.
Okay, well, good. Everybody else does too. All right. No, I think that was a satisfactory answer. And we have less than a minute to go. About a minute to go.
Does anybody have any questions?
Does anybody have any questions on it? All right. If we do, we'll just pick it up next go round.
Okay.
So I think everybody's quiet here, and I hope you take care of yourself and get feeling better.
Thank you.